Mass extinctions. Oh, boy, just what we need. James Rollins will join us. We'll talk about that and some other great things here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let's welcome back James Rollins to Coast to Coast. He decided to become a writer as a young boy, immersed in the scientific adventures of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Doc Savage, and such pulp fiction such as The Shadow, The Spider, The Avenger. Then he honed those storytelling skills, spinning elaborate tales that were often part of pranks that he played on his brothers and sisters. Jim then pursued a career in veterinary medicine, graduating from the fine University of Missouri, establishing a very successful clinic in Sacramento, California. His hands-on knowledge in medicine and science have shaped him to do what he's doing with his works, Bloodline, The Blood Godspell, and The Sixth Extinction. Jim, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me back.
Mass extinction. What do you mean by that?
Well, at this point, the consensus among scientists is that we're at the brink of an ecological disaster. We're losing species on this planet at the rate of 3 species every hour. So during this program, we're going to lose over the next couple hours 6 more species.
Oh,
every year, 30,000 species go extinct. And just they've been tracking this for a while, and they found out that at this point, since the arrival of man on this planet, we've lost about half of the amphibians out there, a quarter of the mammals, 1/3 of the reefs, and this is accelerating. This pace is actually getting worse and worse. And if we don't sort of stem this tide, we're heading towards basically a cliff.
Are the extinctions occurring because man is killing off these animals? I mean, how much are we contributing percentage-wise to this?
Well, we're considered to be the 6th mass extinction. So we've had some hints of what this might look like. In the past, it's usually been natural disasters. It's been volcanic eruptions. It's been asteroid strikes. But in this case, you know, we're that asteroid. We're definitely the one causing this current extinction. And the rate of extinction is about 1,000-fold what it should be. The rate of extinction is documented at a certain 0.01% of the species, or 1,000 times faster than that. And that's because of us, from urbanization, from pollution, from the global spread of invasive species. We're curious species, us humans. We have a tendency to explore, to move, to alter, to change our environment to fit our needs. They don't necessarily fit the needs of other animals out there, and so they have a tendency to expire because of us. And we humans sort of as think that we're invincible, that we're not at the risk of oblivion. But if you look at the dinosaurs, they were on the planet for 65 million years ago, and they had their reign for millions and millions of millennia. But we've, as a human species, have only been around about 200,000 years. So we're really just a brief blip on the geological scale, yet we've caused so much damage. Just recently, I read in Scientific America, this was just about 2 weeks ago, they estimate that we have about 1 or 2 generations to turn this tide around before we do go over that cliff.
Do you think of these past extinctions that we have had, that we can control the possibility of a future extinction?
Let's take one example. Let's go back to the 3rd extinction, sort of give an idea. The 3rd extinction occurred during the Permian period about 250 million years ago. It was believed to be caused by the eruption of a volcano that cast huge clouds of carbon dioxide into the air, causing a greenhouse effect. It acidified the oceans. That extinction knocked out about 90% of the species on the planet. And we're heading toward that same disruption today. You know, because of climate change, we're seeing the same sort of global changes. We're seeing the acidification of the ocean. We're seeing this dead zone spreading. So we're heading basically along the same path that was happening during the Permian extinction. And you know, 90% of the species were knocked off. The planet was literally at a razor's edge of bottoming out, of having to start over. And again, from that Scientific American article, we know that we don't have a whole lot of time to reverse that.
No, we really don't. The clock, James, is clicking along at a pretty rapid pace. You know, we're seeing it also in deformities on animals, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, and we see that a lot in the amphibians. The amphibians are sort of the canary in the coal mine when it comes to environmental damage. That's why we have lost half of all the species that have been lost, the amphibians have been hit the strongest. Amphibians, with their skin, they absorb everything through their skin. They breathe through their skin. So when we have toxins in the environment, we have these changes in the environment, where we see the mutations first, oftentimes, is in the amphibian species because they absorb that into their systems. And so we've seen up in the Pacific Northwest, we're seeing already toads and frogs that are developing third limbs. We're seeing species being wiped out in tremendous numbers. Just that we're seeing that happen in the course of lifespans. We're not talking about anything on a geological stage. We're talking about in just a matter of decades, we're seeing entire species vanishing. And here in the U.S., amphibian species just disappearing.
What about us? What's going to happen to man?
Well, at this point, that's what we're struggling to do with. Many scientists I spoke to when preparing for my new novel, The Sixth Extinction, was what are we doing? What can we do? How is this going to change? How are we going to have to change to deal with this? And if we don't do something, then things are going to change. And it's basically two camps that have arisen to deal with this. There's the conservationists out there. These are the ones that are trying to preserve species. They're what's considered to be old school environmentalists. They believe, trying to preserve the species that are here on the planet. But there's a small camp of them that also believe in resurrecting extinct species, bringing them back to life. And that's one side, the preservationists. And there's a whole new camp of scientists that have arisen over the past couple decades. And these are the synthetic biologists, the ones that believe they can engineer a way out of this extinction. And right or wrong, that's where a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of the young talent out there, young scientists out there, are using genetic manipulation to create synthetic life, create life that they think that can thwart this change.
What's going on in the seas, James, in terms of edible fish life? That's going too, isn't it?
It is, and there's these dead zones that are in different spots around the globe. We have a huge dead spot off the coast of Texas, where the Mississippi alluvial plain drains into the Gulf of Mexico, and these dead zones in the sea are creating these toxic acidified ocean spots, where jellyfish, these ancient jellyfish are reoccurring, where fish are being wiped out. And we're seeing over in Australia, they have these toxic tides that are actually clearing beaches. They're not red tides, but these toxic tides that are developing from these acidified oceans that are closing down beaches, that are causing people to get sick. And these dead zones are spreading. They're multiplying in number and in volume. Basically, they're almost returning these seas to what they looked in the primordial state. They're returning these seas from these rich, abundant sources of environmental diversity, biodiversity, into these stagnant pools where there's just a few forms of life, and usually they're toxic, like the toxic jellyfish, full of bacterial slime, things that are basically are not something that we can survive with.
But we're not going to stop fishing, are we?
No, and that's the other problem, is that we're overfishing. As these dead zones spread, the areas where there is actually viable fish we're seeing almost all of fishing areas becoming more and more threatened.
Some of the animals that we have been known to really like and appreciate, gorillas, lions, elephants, are they in danger of extinction as well?
Oh, they're probably one of the highest threats. These keystone species, these species that are at the top of the food chain, so to speak, and unfortunately, we're also a keystone species. We're also at the top of that pyramid. And if we keep knocking out the bricks at the lower end of that pyramid, everything at the top is going to come tumbling down. So, one of the keystone species are greatly at risk, and unfortunately, we're one of those keystone species.
How do you stop it? Can you stop it?
There is definitely some interesting things going on in that field in regards to what can be done to stop it. And the synthetic biologists are probably the ones that are leading the forefront in regards to finding ways to thwart that. And it's exciting. There's two techniques that were developed just in the last decade. One's called a CRISPR-Cas technique, and one's called a MAGE and CAGE technique. And they're called evolution machines because these two types of genetic manipulation techniques have so increased our ability to manipulate DNA that every year our ability to write and read DNA increases tenfold, which means that if you just look forward 10 years, we're talking about being able to manipulate DNA about 10 billion times faster than we can today. You know, we've already seen just in 2010, a scientist named Craig Venter, created the first synthetically built cell. And just last year, biologists engineered an artificial chromosome and built this functional living yeast from scratch with gaps in its DNA so they can actually put in different elements into the DNA and create sort of designer DNA. You might wonder why they're doing that. And they're doing that because they're able to produce these bioorganisms that theoretically can clean up toxic areas. They're creating bacteria that can clean up oil spills. They're creating different types of organisms that can clean up heavy metal toxin exposures. And there was a fascinating installation by a woman named Alexandra Ginsberg called Designing for the Sixth Extinction. And what she proposes in that installation is the purposeful release of bioengineered creations into the wild. And she's gone to, in this installation, gone so far as even to patent some of these life forms. She has this slug-like creature that can leave this alkali trail to neutralize acidic soil, or this biofilm that can grow on leaves and absorb pollutants out of the air. And we're seeing real practical approaches to this. There's the American chestnut tree, which was common, you know, across the eastern seaboard, you know, back in the 20th century. We had 3 billion of these behemoths, but now they've been reduced to sort of stumps by this fungal blight that was imported from an Asian chestnut tree. Again, an example of an invasive species. Then about 20 years ago, someone had the bright idea of giving this American chestnut a wheat gene and folding a wheat gene into its genetic code. And this wheat gene allows them to break down the fungal toxin. And it has great success with that, to the point where it approved, you know, they're waiting for regulatory approval because it's relatively new information, that they're going to plant a small field of these new trees in the Appalachian Mountains. So we're seeing this new field of synthetic biology beginning to find ways of reversing, cleaning up the environment, hardying, making species a little bit hardier. But of course, that's not without risk. When you start playing in that genetic, that genetic sandbox, things can go awry.
You have talked about scientists in a camp that kind of believe that another mass extinction might be a good thing. How can it be a good thing?
That does sound sort of contradictory.
It sure does.
Because when I was doing the research, I was looking at these two camps, the camps that believe about that they can engineer our way out, the ones that believe they can preserve our way out of this extinction. And then there's a gentleman named, an ecologist named Craig Thomas, who proposed that the extinction might be a good event, that might be actually a healthy event for the planet. That
like a cleansing?
Not so much even a cleansing, is that when we start losing species, we open environmental niches, we open gaps in the environment. And what his belief is that when those gaps occur, nature will find a way to fill those gaps. You know, his statement is that if nature can bounce back from an asteroid hit, it can bounce back from us. And what he really stresses is that we're now in climate change. We're talking about a lot of change occurring. What he wants to see, what he stresses, is not to confuse change with damage. You know, it took the death of dinosaurs to make room for us. Of course, we don't want to necessarily, you know, it might be healthier for the planet to get us off the planet, but, you know, we don't want that. So then change is always happening in nature. It means that some species are going to have to move to survive. Others are going to have to be created along the way from the synthetic biologists. So Craig doesn't say don't do anything. He doesn't want to push us towards the brink of extinction. But he says, you know, we need to recognize this is happening, that this change might be good, that this could actually lead to a new Eden, a new Genesis, and a brand new biosphere out there, and that it's our role to try to guide ourselves towards that end. There's a great quote from that I found when I was doing my research for the book. From Stuart Brand, who wrote the Whole Earth Catalog. He says, you know, we are as gods and have to get good at it. And that's pretty much what Craig is advocating. Yes, this extinction is happening, but I think if we know a little gentle tugging, pushing, adjustments, we can actually end up in a stronger position. One of the counter arguments to Craig's position is the statement that, extinction is fast, but evolution is slow. So the fear is that these emptying mm-hmm. niches will empty out faster than we can recover from. His position is that might be bogus. Recently, they've come to realize that there's evolutionary changes going on now, and it's accelerating. It seems that the rate of evolution is staying in sort of in step with the rate of extinction, and that even though it may look like things are changing rapidly, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
With these extinctions, what are the possibilities if it happens now, and of course it includes man, that we also lose knowledge that we may never be able to recover again?
Well, we've seen that happen in the past. In the beginning of my book, I use an example of that, which is the burning or the destruction of the Lost Library of Alexandria. Now, here's this library in Egypt, holds vast volumes of ancient knowledge. It basically was the storehouse for almost all thinking back in the ancient world. And because of there's some controversy exactly what happened to that library, some believe that it was burned during Julius Caesar's attack of Egypt. Some people believe it was the invading Arabs that just destroyed it. But whatever the cause was, that library was burnt down. Most of those that knowledge vanished into the past. And there's little intriguing examples of that. For example, Greek fire. Here we knew about this napalm-like compound that was developed. The ability to make that was kept in secret, and then it vanished. The ability to make that disappeared for centuries. No one knew how to recreate this Greek fire, this incendiary device that when you threw water on, actually spread the fire rather than dousing the fire. Until napalm was invented. That napalm is believed to be sort of a version of that ancient Greek fire. So definitely, not only do we have to worry about the loss of biology out there when it comes to extinction, is we also run the risk of losing knowledge.
Why aren't these species that are going extinct have the ability to fight back genetically?
Fight back genetically, there's an interesting article about, this actually just happened in the New York Times today, about the fact that, our biome, the bacteria that are in our systems right now, they probably control us more than we think they do. There's some bacteria that produce chemicals that are similar to our own neurons that communicate with each other. They produce dopamine, serotonin. And it's believed that these microbes actually influence our behavior. And so we think as human beings that we're the top of the chain, that we have free will, that we have control. We're finding more and more that we are creatures of our genetics, and we're also creatures of these biomes that are in our system. The fact that these gut bacteria can change the biochemistry of our brain is significant. There's also parasites that we know that can also affect people, like toxoplasmosis that's in cats that can affect humans, that also change and alter our behavior, which is sort of creepy. I found out when doing my research for this book that there are actually scientists looking for ways to manipulate these bacteria and parasites to actually control human behavior.
The sixth extinction. Now, if it occurs, James, when could it be?
Well, at this point, Scientific American said we have one or two generations to turn this around. So we're actually in the sixth extinction right now. If we don't turn this around in the next 75 years or so, we will see the beginning of total ecological collapse.
Well, then how do you turn it around? It's got to be done on a global effort, a global scale, and that's pretty difficult to do.
It is, but we have, we caused this problem. It's our curiosity, like I mentioned before, that sort of led us into this. It's our human nature that brought us to this brink, but also our human nature has the ability to reverse that. We're especially here in the U.S., we really encourage scientific ingenuity when whenever there's some new scientific advancement seems to be coming from the U.S. because we sort of think outside the box, and we have a whole new slew of these young scientists coming out there that are well aware of the state that we're in, and they're aiming towards that. There's a newest study that was done by Scripps University, Scripps Institute, back in May, just this May of this year, where they produced these living replicating bacteria that contain new letters of the genetic alphabet.
Huh, amazing. Hey, I want to talk with you about the Nazi bell when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, James Rawlins with us, one of his books, The Sixth Extinction. James, I do want to talk with you a little bit about the World War II Nazi bell. That was a bizarre apparatus. Tell me what you know about it.
I love that. I'm always looking when I'm writing my stories about these historical mysteries, is these pieces of history that end in a question mark. And the bell, to me, is one of the more fascinating ones out there. And in the last months of World War II, as Germany was falling, it became this sort of this gold rush among the Allies to plunder the technology of these Nazi scientists. There was a race between the Brits, the Americans, the French, and mostly the Russians. And during that time, a bunch of patents were stolen from these German labs that led to things like vacuum tubes today, to chemicals used in manufacturing and plastics. Even the pasteurizing milk using UV light came from a German lab. But the more interesting project is this sort of shadowy project called Die Glocke, or the bell. The Germans did not give up their technology easily. They believed that this bell was in a research lab buried in a border between Poland and Germany. They had these buried labs, throughout Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. But we knew about these labs, and one of the teams that actually went in there to start looking at this, it was a group of Britons that were actually led by Ian Fleming, the future creator of James Bond, was in one of these plundering groups out there. But the bell has some interesting things about it. We just know certain details about it. We know the bell was operating out of this lab. When this bell device was turned on, people in the surrounding countryside reported strange lights. They reported mysterious illnesses. They reported deaths. The Russian forces were the first ones to reach that. They found that this site was deserted. All 62 scientists involved in the project were killed, and they were buried in a mass grave. And the device itself vanished. So there's a lot of controversy about what that device was. Certain things we know that it wasn't. It wasn't a nuclear device. They were working with something entirely different. We get these cryptic clues about what it was. They believe that it was a device that was potentially tapping into strange energies.
Was it a UFO, a downed craft?
That is one of the theories, is that they were working on some type of aircraft, possibly from something that was not from this world. It was fueled by this metallic liquid called Serum 525. It was stored in a tall, thin thermos flask, about a meter tall, encased in lead. At this point, where it vanished to, there's a lot of different thoughts about it. There's a book by Nick Cook that I just love called The Hunt for Zero Point that deals with the search for this bell. Some people advocate that the bell vanished into South America. Nick advocates that it actually probably came into the U.S. as a part of Operation Paperclip, where many of these Nazi scientists were snuck over into the U.S. and were put into different types of black op U.S. programs. And some people believe that what this goal of the bell was to tap into quantum energies, to tap into the zero point energy as a infinite source of power. And some people believe that technology is actually being incorporated into some of the advances we're seeing coming out of these black op projects today. It can be tied back to World War II, tied back to this mysterious bell.
Where do you think it could be now? It's anybody's guess, I guess.
It's exactly anybody's guess. Nick's guess is that technology was brought to the U.S. shores, that it was divided among multiple programs. Programs that involve not just in military aircraft, but also in projects that are even more theoretically esoteric, like using these quantum energy to break into the time stream and actually creating mini time warps. So there's some intriguing things that Nick was, it sounds pretty far-fetched, but Nick actually interviewed different scientists in Canada and the U.S. that admit that they were working on projects tied to the bell.
The Nazis were obsessed with Antarctica. They went there a lot. What were they looking for?
Well, again, that's one of the historical aspects I raised in the Sixth Extinction, because I'm always fascinated by Antarctica. I went to Antarctica, and it's just a strange continent, and we're just barely sort of scratching the frozen surface of that continent. And it's not just my own curiosity. This curiosity about that continent goes back decades, goes back to World War II. There's a great article called Britain's Secret War in Antarctica by James Robert. You can find it online. I encourage everybody to read it. That specifically talks about this German interest in Antarctica, and specifically under Antarctica. We do know certain facts that are indisputable, that the Nazis were exploring that coast. They carved out a part of the Norwegian territory to form their own little colony down there, and they believed that they were doing the setting up a submarine base down there for their U-boats. And then the question was, were they successful? During that period of time, both the Brits and the Americans were, there was almost like a secret war going on that southern continent to find out where the Germans were, what they were doing, and potentially what they discovered. But what's really interesting was that, you know, when after the war, all the major players in Nazi Germany ended up in British hands. You know, Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler. But most importantly, the head of the German Navy was a gentleman named the Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz. And the Brits had unfettered access to these heads of Nazi Germany well before the U.S. or the Soviet did. And there's certain oddities about the story of Karl Dönitz. So here is the head of the German Navy, yet, you know, following the end of World War II, as all these other heads were either killed, committed suicide, or given extraordinarily long prison sentences, this head of the Nazi U-boat, these boats that were scouring and dropping ships left and right, was given only 7 years in jail. And many people believe he got such a light sentence because he was cooperating with the British, that he was giving them information in exchange for a lighter sentence.
Sure, he must have cut a deal.
Exactly. And what's even more cryptic, and this you can read this in the Nuremberg trial records, is that Karl Dönitz actually boasted about Nazi discoveries in Antarctica. There's a quote that he says, they found an invulnerable fortress, a paradise-like oasis in the middle of eternal ice. So he definitely seems like the Germans found something down there, something they were keeping secret. The Brits knew it first, and the Brits are the one country that is most active in exploring Antarctica. They were it's the first scientists down there. They are still down there. The British Antarctic Survey is one of the largest groups doing research down there. So it just makes me wonder, you know, what did the Brits learn from Karl Dönitz? Are they still searching or doing some research down there tied back to that period of time?
You've looked at the Middle East as well. It was once flush with rivers, lakes, streams. What the heck happened to it?
That's a good question. I mean, I love the little piece of history, like what happened to the fact that, you know, back in the past, thousands of years ago, the deserts of Oman, where, you know, they once were, you know, rich with life. They had rivers, lakes, streams. They had, you know, hunters roaming the land. But then the whole area began to turn to desert. And what caused that is a sort of a global phenomenon called orbital forcing or Milankovitch forcing. It's basically a wobble in the Earth's rotation that occurs at periodic intervals. About every 20,000 years, the Earth will have this little wobble in it. And when the Earth wobbles, there's massive climatic changes that occur. They believe that the last wobble causes that desertification of Arabia, India, Africa, and Australia. But we don't really know what caused it. You know, some people guess it's precession. It's just a natural, a periodic change in the Earth's orbit. Might be something more dramatic, like a flip-flop of the Earth's polarity that occurs 1,000 times in geological history. And some people might just be a burp in the rotation of the Earth's core. No one can really say, but when this happens, it's dramatic, it's Earth-altering, and it's possibly life-ending. But what's even more disturbing, from all the trends of looking at the pattern of orbital forcing, we're due for that to happen again.
Well, history does repeat itself, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
What has fascinated you? Well, I've got to ask. Let me ask you this first. You also did research about genetics that says that humans might have been cannibals once.
And that, again, is fascinating, what's lurking in our DNA code, you know, what scientists have found out from examining this human genome project and what we've learned. And actually, that's a true statement. The basis for that sort of accusation came from a team of researchers in London. They were studying mad cow disease. They were studying these different types of prion-like disease. Prions are these little sort of multiplying protein pieces that cause great neurological damage. And these geneticists were studying this tribe, a headhunting tribe in New Guinea, and they found out that this tribe was being devastated by a prion disease called kuru. And you only get kuru, basically, from the practice of eating human brains. And because this tribe has been doing this for generations, they began to develop a gene that protects against the damage from Kuru. And so they thought, well, that was interesting, but so it was, is it just this tribe? So they went ahead and they started doing genetic tests around the globe, studying different people from around the whole planet, and they found that all of us, for some reason, is carrying that same protective code somewhere buried in our DNA, suggesting that in the past, we were all, you know, consuming human flesh, and that we developed this little gene to protect against these damaging prionic type of diseases from eating human flesh, and that's buried in our genetic code, suggesting that in the past, that was more prevalent.
Pretty amazing stuff. How did you come across most of these stories, James?
You know, I love doing my research for my books. You know, at the end of all my books, I have a what's true and what's not section where I lay out, you know, where the history came from, where the science came from. I love talking to people. I mean, one advantage of the internet is you have instant access to information, which is great. But I oftentimes like actually, you know, getting the information straight from the horse's mouth. So I'm notorious for calling scientists, interviewing them. Did that for this book, The Sixth Extinction. Talked to all these different geneticists out there, to all the different people working in this genetic playground. But I also love talking to scientists. It's amazing if you approach somebody and say, "I'm a writer working on this project. Will you help me out?" My book, Deep Fathom, I needed to crash the space shuttle at the beginning of that book, but I knew there was a new evacuation system in the space shuttle. Just didn't know what it was. Could not find the information online, so I contacted the gentleman who developed NASA's website, sent him an email, said, "Hey, I'm a writer. I'm thinking of crashing the space shuttle. I know there's new evacuation systems. Can you help me?" Sent that out into the ether. 3 days later, I come home from work, and leaning on my front door is the operations manual for the space shuttle. So theoretically, if it comes down to it, I can pilot the space shuttle at this point. But it gets a little bit weirder and stranger, that story, is that the manual did not have any postage on it. There was no address on it. It was just the manual leaning on my front door. Somebody had hand-delivered it. Now, at that time, I was living in Sacramento, California, which is the head of the, you know, they have a lot of aerospace lobbyists there, and somebody must have had a copy of this manual laying around to, you know, go give it to this Rollins guy. So I went to go ahead and thank the gentleman who facilitated this person I emailed. And I went back and I realized nowhere in my email had I ever put my address. So in 3 days, they found out who I was, where I lived, and delivered the manual. Now, I doubt that had necessarily so much to do with I'm a writer, help me out. Possibly had more to do with, you know, I'm thinking of crashing the space shuttle somewhere in my email, that set up some red flags to facilitate that. But it's, you know, it's information like that that I love to come across, is, you know, talking to these scientists. Oftentimes they will give you information that they might not put in print, information that they're willing to share, sub rosa, a little on the secret side, that all becomes a basis for a lot of my stories.
Jim, tell me about your work, Bloodline. Give me that overview.
Well, Bloodline was a fun book to write. The main characters in that book is a former Army Ranger and his military war dog. I had done a USO tour to Iraq and Kuwait back in the winter of 2010. We were sort of a test balloon by the USO to see whether the men and women out in the field would want to have authors. And they usually have entertainers, they have comedians, they have rock stars, cheerleaders, and it's like, hey, here's authors. So we were a test balloon to see if, you know, if they would want us there, and we were surprised at how warm that reception was. These guys, you know, one of the guys said, you know, finally somebody's here that we want to talk to, which was very flattering in regards to, you know, these men and women in the field. They're smart. They have these little pockets in their pants. They shove these little paperback novels, so they're great readers. But, you know, it was while I was out there that I saw these military working dogs working in the field. I talked to the handlers out there that were working with these dogs. You know, my background is veterinary medicine, so, of course, I see puppies out in the field. I'm going to go talk to them. And so I talked to the gentleman, and I found out this sort of intense relationship between the handler and the dog. I kept hearing this phrase over and over again. It runs down the lead, which what they're trying to say is that over time, up and down that leash that connects handler and dog, their emotions run up and down, and they bond together really tightly because they eat together, train together, play together. And over time, the dog can read the handler can read the dog. And it's that type of relationship that was very unique. One guy said, you know, I think my dog understands me better than my own wife does. So, you know,
that's possible.
I'm just fascinated about that human-animal bond. It's an intriguing piece of science I don't think has been properly explored, like the fact that when you pet a cat or you pet a dog, your blood pressure goes down. There seems to be so this innate bond between humans and animals, and this whole extinction event, of course, brings up that the risk of damaging that bond.
Did you specialize in any specific breed as a vet?
Well, I was trained in both small and large animal, but I did my practice that I ran for 15 years was all small animal and exotic. It was one of two practices dealing with birds and mammals, I mean, small mammals. So it was fascinating dealing with multiple different forms of life.
More cats, more dogs with the ownership?
I would say at this point it was more cats. I mean, cats are a little more versatile in regards to you don't have to
almost self-sufficient, aren't they?
They're more self-sufficient, exactly.
And dogs, you got to take them out. Cats, they know exactly what to do. And they take care of business, and off they go. You've talked a little bit about dark energy. Have you tried to figure out what the heck that is, Jim?
I've tried to, and I'm not sure I was necessarily successful, but again, that is one of the theories, going back to the conversation about the bell. One of the theories that Nick had was that that the bell was potentially trying to tap into this quantum energy, this energy that's causing the molecules to vibrate at the very small level. You know, to this day, it's dark energy is sort of a mysterious force that makes up about three-quarters of the universe, because it's sort of almost a mathematical little plug-in. And why is the universe expanding at an accelerating rate? Something's pushing that universe to expand faster than it should be. And so they've said, well, it's got to be an energy source that's doing that, but we don't know what it is. But whatever it is, it makes up three-quarters of the universe. So it definitely seems to be something tied to the quantum field. Most of the scientists I talked to, I went to Fermilab outside of Chicago again. I'd love to have people tell me things rather than them me having to look it up. And so I went to Fermilab outside of Chicago, which is one of the big physics labs, and was able to view their work on dark energy. They developed a dark energy camera. It's a 570 megapixel camera. It's an array that they're setting up in Chile. The camera is so strong that when they turn it on, they believe they're going to be able to peer back about three-quarters of the way back to the Big Bang. And they believe that once that camera is turned on, they're going to have better answers on exactly what this dark energy is, how it fundamentally makes up the universe, and is there a way for us to tap into that?
I think science is amazing. It really is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, that's the sandbox I love to play in with my books, is not only looking at those historical pieces of history that end in a question mark, but also looking at, you know, where we're heading as a species. You know, science is always sort of the subject matter that looks to the future. It's where we're headed next. You can't really look at the pathway of humankind without studying, you know, the scientific community. You know, the science is what sort of drives the human engine forward.
Where are we headed as a society, James? I mean, are we going to make it?
Well, I had a conversation with a gentleman just recently, and the one worry that he had is that, you know, the difference between the U.S. and a lot of the other countries out there is that we have a tendency as our country, as a nation, sort of our zeitgeist as Americans, is we look forward, we look to the future, we're looking through the windshield of this car that's being driven forward, and unfortunately, other species, other countries that are only looking in the rearview mirror. You know, we have the war going on in Iraq because of things that occurred 900 years ago. So, you know, hopefully we'll be the ones driving this car forward.
We're going to come back and take phone calls with our final hour to go on Coast to Coast AM.